Welcome. We're back from our August break with episode 235 of Troubadours and Rock On Tours with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. It's so nice to be back. When we start off this season with a regular contributor and great, great friend, a sage, really. There it is, Almighty Todd, talking with us from his place, his farm in Stockbridge, Vermont. And we discuss Mexican bread in Houston, Labor Day, unions, the robber barons, drones, societal clash, leadership, and leaders as opposed to elected officials, a decent standard of living, yin-yang, education, history, and just, you know, collectivism. Is it dead? And how important is it? It's a great conversation with Almighty Todd. We also have an EW essay by yours truly titled Quietly Listens, and a poem titled Beckons You, and an excerpt from Sinclair Lewis's novel Dodsworth. All of this, as is always the case, is ensconced within several great tunes. So nice to have you with us. Let's get to it. Episode 235 of Troubadours and Rock On Tours.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see, no, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid. Just as long as you stand by me. So dark. Stand by me. If the sky that we look upon should tumble and fall, or the mountain should crumble to the sea, I won't cry, I won't cry. No, I won't shed a tear. Just as long as you stand by me. And darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand now. Stand by me. Stand by me. Stand by me. Whenever you're in trouble, won't you stand by me? Oh, stand by me. Whoa, stand by me.
Quietly listen. As wary as a coal mine canary, don't call this Mary Jane, just Mary. I'm hoping for the sake of the Jake, and to defend against the evil snake, that we are not susceptible to the temptation of being on the take. Hoping with the naivete of the blue sky day, that our souls are more whole and deep, and our minds play rational and ethical for keeps, though it seems that we might not be there when I witness again and again the empty ass stare of another unmoored id, ignorant and hungry, lost, believing, lazy, and gluttonous is home. As if it is what it is, chimes as a sage mantra, rather than as it is ineptly designed, somewhat like an interior done in beige, with hints and accents of pepper spray and sun-dried cilantro. And yet, still hopeful, this balding boy dost be, as the end of summer glistens, we sit with the crickets and in comfort quietly listen.
1, 2, 3.
This spring morning, there's not a cloud in the sky, and it's got me out here walking and waving to the ladies as they stroll by. And I ain't forgot for a moment all the things I need to do. But when I see that old sun shining, makes me think that I can make it too. Yes, and all I really wanna say is that the problems come and go, but the sunshine seems to stay. And just look around, I think we found a lovely day. The flowers woke up blooming and put on a color show just for me. I appreciate it. The shadows dark and gloomy, I told them all to keep the hell away from me, because I don't feel like believing everything I do gone turn out wrong. Or when vibrations I'm receiving say, hold on, brother, just you be strong. Yes, and all I really wanna say is that the problems come and go, but the sunshine seems to stay. Just look around, I think we found a lovely day. Sometimes it rains, and I feel kind of strange, because it seems like my problems begin without the sunshine on which I depend. And all that make me feel like I need to hear the sun say is, hey, just look around, I think we found a lovely day. I think we found a lovely day. I think we found a lovely, lovely, don't it feel like a lovely day?
Almighty Todd, Almighty Todd, is that you?
Hello, Mr. Conundrum.
It's a pleasure to have you on the program.
Good to hear from you.
Yeah, same here, brother. I mean, just coming back from our annual August break with Troubadours and Rock on Tours, and rejuvenated. And I like to start the new season with a fresh yet wise perspective, and I think you fit the bill, of course.
Well, wise ass perspective, maybe, but
that works too.
And a little bit fresh, yeah.
You want to talk about? I know one thing you want to talk about in particular is Mexican bread in Houston. I don't know what else you want to talk about this go around. How's everything? How's everything in Vermont?
It's going okay. Yeah. I mean, it's Labor Day weekend, and you know, I always think of Labor Day as this. You know, it's themed the unofficial end of summer, but I kind of keep summer all the way through September because it holds fast up here pretty well. But it is that weekend when you try and get all the work done that you didn't get done during the summer that you thought you would.
Is that what's going on, yeah?
Yeah, I'm just trying to play catch up on some stuff, some projects and things like that, because the weather's going to turn before we know it, and it'll be a whole different story.
Yeah.
But, you know, but you think Labor Day, it's funny. You know, we're at this point in time where Labor Day was originally intended to celebrate the trade unions and the labor movements in the United States, and goes back to the late 1800s.
Yeah.
And boy, if you look at things, the way things are going in this day and age for labor unions and the middle class manufacturing force and workers of all kinds. And it makes me think that the way things are going and the way executive orders are getting reversed and regulations are getting reversed and protections are getting reversed, that within a couple of years, this holiday might be artificial intelligence and capital gains day.
Maybe. Yeah, I think the private workforce, the number of people in unions now is in the single digits. You know, it's incredibly low, and I think maybe a half a century or less back, maybe a third was more like it. So it's precipitously declined, the number of people in unions in the private sector. Public sector a little bit bigger, union based, but still. I say we're because I'm part of a union. We are getting, you know, weaker, and the government is no friend, really, especially the federal government today.
No, federal or state governments, and the overall, you know, the economics factors and where jobs have gone has also drained energy from the unions.
Yeah, and I mean, why is that a bad thing in your view? Maybe it's, you know, it's a free market, it's capitalism. Unions lost.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, and sometimes they lost because they got beaten up by the owners of corporations, and at some point the government had to step in and say, no, workers need certain protections. They're a vital part of the economy, and you know, so. Unions have shrunk, and it's also been harder for other sectors to form unions, like people that do home health care for the elderly or for, you know, the infirm and, you know, the fast food workers. You know, would they be needing to lobby for, you know, either municipal or state minimum wage gains if they as a labor force had the bargaining power to make the market move the compensation?
Well,
I don't know. I mean, I'm no expert in labor relations or labor law or by any stretch of the imagination. You have far more experience than I do in those zones. But I think about it because, you know, this is another holiday like Memorial Day that has become more about corporate sponsorship by football teams and Charbroil and Budweiser. Sorry, I shouldn't have even given them plugs.
No, you shouldn't have.
You can bleep that out.
Yeah.
Well, but you know what I mean. It's like the what the holiday stands for has kind of lost its meaning for pretty much everybody. I don't know if even folks that are in unions take it to heart.
No,
I mean, as somebody that you, I mean, I ask you.
I think people are not aware generally in our country. about the history of our country, and of course they aren't aware of the labor movement's history. No, I don't think they are. I think a big part of the problem too is collectivism. That whole idea of collectivism is not a very strong sort of idea in people's minds in the United States of America.
Well, in other people's minds, it's in the United States, it's demonized.
Right. Right. If not, without any thought, it's if there is a thought that comes with collectivism, it's a negative one often. Yeah, they're socialists or they're communists. Now, the other side of it is unions.
I don't mean to jump in, but that just made me think. You know, because there is such like disconnect, even possibly hypocrisy, in that zone. Because I saw a political cartoon where there was a guy. He's drenched. Obviously must have been flooded. He's got a T on his hat and his shirt says, "Get the government off my back," but he's wrapped in a FEMA blanket.
Right, right, exactly. That people see the value of collectivism when we have natural disasters such as Harvey that has occurred in Houston is now moving to the east. But why do you have to wait for disasters? I mean, there's a long-term tragedy, I would hazard to say, that occurs for a generation to the next generation of families and individuals when people aren't allowed to make a good wage, to have time off to spend with their family, don't have good health care. That and all of those aspects of life are guaranteed when a union is in place. Now, the other side of it is...
Or at least that's the goal.
That's the goal. And the other side
of it is crazy because that should be the goal of everybody.
It should be. And unions, though, have been guilty, too. Because unions, like anything human-made, when they get big enough, they become corrupt and somewhat arrogant. And unions have done that as well in many instances. And unfortunately, all unions then are associated with those that have acted poorly and have taken advantage by just spending
too much
money.
How come that doesn't work for senators?
Yeah, good point. Good point. I don't know.
You want it fresh.
I don't know why it doesn't work for senators or for the president of the United States of America right now. Why do those folks, those power mongers, get away with graft and arrogance? Unethical behavior. Why? I don't know. That's a good point.
It's not unethical if you don't have ethics to begin with.
Well, objectively speaking, it's not unethical to them. No, because they don't see it. So, I'm concerned about unions as well. And I do right now where I live. The school year is just about to start, and there are several school districts that are seriously considering going on strike. And that's because, the wages in their view aren't good enough, and, health care is being whittled away, and they have to pay more and with less coverage, things such as that. But at the same time, the municipalities that these districts are in are poor. And everything is reliant on property tax. And, the pensions also that are just draining all this money from people that don't have it. So there's a larger problem that basically makes us all go to the lowest common denominator, as you pointed out. Everybody should have a high quality of life with regard to their pay and their time off and their health insurance. And unions seek that because they know it's healthy, it's right. But no one gets it anymore, so why should they is the mentality. And we can't afford it. We can't afford it for them because we're struggling too. Because something's broken, larger in the system. The system is broken, our society, our capitalistic system.
Amen, brother. I don't know. I mean, I wish I had answers for you, but yeah, it seems like we have to go through these cycles. We've talked about this before. It was the robber barons in the late 1800s. Where capitalism has to be reined in, and unless there's a societal will to do so, it doesn't happen. because, and you can see, I mean, we're moving in this place where the robber barons are no longer building railroads. They're building derivative swap schemes.
And there's no jobs that come with that, really.
Right, right.
At least when they're building railroads, you can get some work.
Yeah, but then, you know, if you're, as long as you're not exploiting the people who are building the railroad for you.
Good. Yeah, true.
The exploitation is just kind of changing forms. So,
yeah.
Anyways, yeah. Happy Labor Day.
Happy Labor Day. Happy Labor Day, ladies and gentlemen. So
keep up, you know, work hard, keep up the good. I mean, that's the bottom line is for each of us in our own lives. We have to keep up the work.
For what reason? You mean just to sustain ourselves or just...
It's multi-layered, but yeah, to sustain ourselves, to sustain our families, to sustain our communities. And, you know, as much as there are these bigwigs making crap storms at the top, it's all of us individuals on the ground doing our work and being productive that moves things forward.
Yeah, but aren't we just being drones then?
Well, it depends. I mean, yeah, you can choose to be a drone. You can choose to plug in and watch 18 hours of TV a week. Actually, I guess that's low. I guess, you know, there's people watch more than that. And you can choose to have a channel on, a certain news channel, and on the background 24 hours a day, inundating you with inanity.
Sean Hannity? Is that what you said? Sean
yeah,
Hannity?
Yeah, I think that's what I said. You know, that's the personal work. You know, that's not just the work of going to your job and being productive and making money. It's the daily work of living life and engaging in life and engaging in our community. And how much time you spend doing that versus how much time you just spend consuming.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, the collective mentality has to be exercised as a member of the community. You have to be a member of your community. Otherwise, we lose touch with the commonality, the human experience and connection that we all should be aware of, and we do indeed, I think, share.
And that's what makes you want to make sure that your neighbors are also making a decent living, and that their kids are making it through school. Because, you know, these things that you've talked about in terms of inequities and living in poverty and being undereducated, that stuff has an epigenetic effect on people. Living in stress, especially for kids, has an enormous effect on how they develop genetically and their proclivity for poor health outcomes down the road. These are all societal costs that we assume if we don't invest on the front end.
The front end being?
Being making sure that everybody has, you know, a decent standard of living, decent education. Decent health care.
Yeah.
You know, that's why those are fundamental parts of a functioning and healthy society, a functioning and healthy nation.
And you don't think we're there now in the United States of America?
I don't think we are. I don't think that the systems have matured enough to recognize that those are some of the most important things to pay attention to. And that if you do that, productivity for everybody goes up.
And is it that those in power don't read these studies and these reports about human tendency and behavior, or they just don't care?
Well, there's a little bit of both. I mean, you have to believe in science, number one, to even read the studies. And if you're more interested in a resource grab for yourself because that's what the current system allows, then humans, lesser angels, will show themselves, even if they are in higher seats of power.
Yeah, there's definitely a vacuum when it comes to leadership at the municipal, the state, the federal level, and you need strong leadership, I think, because to share these ideas and to connect us, I think citizens right now are just struggling so much, I'm aimless with regard to my community. I don't know what the hell is going on, because there's so much, there's so much ineptitude, and just, you know, personal interest that drives the politicians that I see for the most part. There's a few good ones here and there. It starts at the municipal level and it goes right up to, you know, obviously to Washington these days, for sure. And I mean, it leaves me feeling aimless and disconnected and disheartened. Maybe that's why we watch 10 hours of TV a day, to escape.
Yeah, that's exactly it. But, you know, strong leaders rise out of strong communities. You know, weak leaders rise out of weak communities.
Well,
I feel like that's probably, you know, maybe I'm being way overgeneralizing, you know, in that respect. But, you know, the demands we put on our neighbors, or the expectations we put on our neighbors and ourselves and how we interact with one another, is the guiding force. You know, I feel like we're at a point now where we can't look to our leaders, quote unquote leaders, I won't even call them leaders, because I don't feel that that's the role that they play. They are simply elected officials right now, and the methods and factors by which they get elected are suspect. And that, you know, there's that bumper sticker says the people lead, the leaders will follow them. I, you know, that's a little bit trite, but I do get it. I get the concept, is that if we, you know, we have to raise our own expectations for the people that sit in these seats if we want things to get better.
I agree. Don't you think, though, given the problems with our education system, as we've mentioned,
yes,
and the fact that we don't understand history so much, and there are so many in the United States, I know for sure, so many ways.
Many people are saying Douglas is doing a great job.
Right, exactly, the history part. But there are so many ways that we are taken away from really focusing on what it means to be alive and what it means to be a citizen and what it means to be a strong-minded, educated individual. You know, there are so many distractions, so many. I don't believe we even know about it. I think we're hypnotized to a large extent. I don't even think we're aware of it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's why that tune out that was in the 60s, I think on some levels people do need to consider doing that, or, you know, creating a space in their day where they do put the phone aside so they're not looking at Facebook or what's the latest best cat video. Not that I don't like cat videos. But yeah, it's personal discipline. You know, and you know, this is where there is a certain very conservative faction that talks about personal responsibility, but I think that it gets warped a lot of the time and puts personal responsibility on people that do not have means.
Right.
In a lot of ways.
Right. Just ignoring puts social responsibility.
It puts responsibility on people that have no ability to meet those responsibilities. That's not correct. But I'm talking about just each and every one of us, you know, personal discipline and responsibility. You know, I got to catch myself saying, you know, I'm not going to watch Netflix tonight. I'm either going to read a book or I'm going to bed early so I can get up early and do something else. I have to have that talk with myself periodically.
Yeah, I lose that argument. Netflix wins usually.
We got to bleep the brand names out again.
We do. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking to Almighty Todd, a regular contributor to Troubadours and Rock On Tours. I'm EW Conundrum. And we took the month of August off, as is our tradition here on Troubadours and Rock On Tours. And this is the first episode, 235, but the first of the new season. We have a lot of great guests coming up this year, and Almighty Todd is starting us off. We're talking about Labor Day and labor and unions and a decent standard of living, education, being a drone, leadership, elected officials, so many interesting things. The fact that capitalism is sick, society is lost, perhaps. Or maybe I just don't get it, Todd.
No, I think there are systemic problems, but people, individuals still show through. And so there was that article I sent you about the bakery.
The Mexican bread, right?
Yes.
In Houston. during Harvey. Yeah, that's a great story.
Yeah, and this is, you know, it's a great story on a lot of levels. Because it's
share it with the folks. Share it with the folks. Give us a synopsis.
Well, just, you know, if you the quick synopsis is that there's a Mexican bakery that's been there for a few generations. It's an immigrant family that's done well by themselves and for the community, and they're a much loved fixture. And the some bakery workers found themselves trapped by the floodwaters, and they just figured out what they needed to do was they just started baking bread, and they baked like 4,400 pounds, I think.
It's like 4,000 loaves or something.
Well, they made a ton of bread. And when the owner showed up the next day, he was like, okay, we got to start distributing this. And they took it to shelters. And it's like, without even a moment's notice, these people and this business owner took it upon themselves to, you know, throw everything they had into the community.
Right.
And, you know, having been through a flood situation myself, you know, my heart really goes out to the folks down there because I know what a big traumatic experience it is. And we were okay. We had friends that lost their homes. And
it's up there in Vermont a few years ago. Yeah. Flooding. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was just 6 years ago. And this, you know, brings up a lot of memories of what it was like. And, you know, there's a property just across the river from us that just finally, the end of June, finished up its FEMA flood mitigation buyout. So it's, you know, almost 6 years later and that business is still being tied up. And so even though people say, oh, we're going to get back quickly and all, it's going to be a long road for a lot of people. And I guess I heard something on the order of 364,000 FEMA applications have already been placed. There's 500,000 vehicles in one county alone that have been destroyed. It's just – it's an enormous, enormous thing for that populace, for the fourth biggest city in the United States.
Yeah. I mean 30% of the city was submerged from what I understand. And you know, we also have to, I think, bring up that it would have happened regardless because it was, you know, they said a 500-year storm. But it was even worse, I believe, because of poor environmental regulation in Houston. There's no zoning laws, tons of pavement.
There are no zoning laws, and that – that's a really big problem if you're building in a flood prone area, which Houston is.
Will we learn from that? You know, I asked the question and again,
I don't go back to
the bakery. Those folks are Mexican American. And you know, they want to build a wall.
Well, they're American Mexicans,
American Mexicans. Well,
when people bring that stuff up, I flip it around. If you're here on a green card, then you're still a Mexican American.
But they're looked at because
if you're a citizen here, then you're an American Mexican.
I get you. I consider myself an Italian American, and I'm a citizen. But I understand what you're saying, though. It doesn't make a difference. They still look Mexican, I presume. So people are going to look at them as, you know, the other. And, you know, that they shouldn't be here. And when you look at history, actually, they've always been here. We took over.
They were here first.
Yeah, they were here before us. We just kind of took over their country, you know, way back. We bought it or whatever. I think we took it.
Oh, there was one protest sign that I saw that just said, LOL, your grandchildren are going to be brown.
That's funny. Oh, man. So do we learn? Will we learn, you know, from some of these experiences? Will we soften up? Will we break out of our hypnosis? And why does it take tragedy in extreme situations for us to get there as another question, included?
It always does. Yeah. It comes down to even for people, you know, whether it's people, municipal, state, federal, it takes tragedy for us to reset our mindset or some you know, amazing event to shake us up.
Right.
And so, you know, but I think people do change. Ideas change. There was actually a piece I was hearing about a development in New York. A company had bought land that they were going to develop a new building on, and they bought it right like a month or two before Superstorm Sandy. And so pretty much everybody on the design team had some experience of the storm and brought that with them to the architecture. Mm-hmm. And so what they did was they built a different kind of building so that all of the mechanicals for the building, instead of being down in the basement, are up on the second floor. And the building has generation capacity that, as long as natural gas comes in, it can run its whole self indefinitely. There are pumps built into the basement. The lobby area is all stone and glass, so that if it gets inundated, which they expect it will be again at some point, it'll be easy to clean up. And so, you know, there's this dual thing that's going on in terms of climate change and doing what we can to mitigate the things we can in terms of our behavior that are exacerbating climate change. But then on the other hand, there's this, the coping aspect.
Right. You have to do both simultaneously.
You got to do both simultaneously, even though, you know, right now we are under an administration that is moving backwards in every way possible.
Right. On purpose, it seems.
Now, purposely, yeah.
You know, we're just about out of time, and I just want to, you know, there's so much more we can talk about, and I love talking with you, Todd, Almighty Todd. If we take hold of and embrace and nurture our ingenuity, our souls, our spirits, you know, all the good in us, we can do amazing things, and as individuals and collectively. Yet all too often, we fall into the depravity or the laziness, the sloth, the, you know, the demons rather than the better angels, as you mentioned earlier. And I hope we can do the former more so than the latter.
Well, I think it's that we're doing both at the same time. There's always this urge to move forward and better our situation, and there's an impetus to do that. And I think that it still is the greater impetus for most. That sometimes gets warped into only for me or my clan. And I think that tribal mindsets is one of the biggest challenges to the modern age.
Yes, I agree.
Is us moving beyond that. Geez, I even lost where I was going. But the point being is that we're moving forward all the time, but there is always a drag. There are the anchors of our vices. There are the anchors of reactionary thinking. It's like the yin yang. It's like it may be moving forward, but there's always some piece of moving backward inside of it. It, you know, and we just manage that. It's the dichotomy there that keeps things moving. You know, I try to keep it in perspective and think that, you know, what we're seeing right now is a part of a waning cyclic phase of a mindset that really will no longer exist in years to come, but there's a gasp before its demise. And I'm hoping that that's what we're looking at these days in terms of the push backwards into the past.
Well put. Thank you. Thank you, Almighty Todd, for talking with us on Troubadours and Rock on Tours. We'll be talking to you again soon this season. It's always a pleasure. I hear the birds and the crickets up there at your place in Vermont, and it's very endearing. Thank you. Thank you for sharing those as well.
Thanks for calling, my brother.
Ciao.
Now that you need in your world, lay your burdens on my shoulders for a while until it's over. I'm gonna love you like we're all each other half. Well, I've got friends and I've got family. But don't you dare believe them.
try to tell you everything happens for a reason, because it doesn't mean a goddamn thing. There's chaos in the violence, and it's so insensitive to claim when there are those who suffer for no reason. Loss of those you love. Yes, I've got family, I've got friends, and I will love them till the end, despite the batshit crazy things they often say. But don't you dare believe them when they try to tell you everything happens for a reason, because it doesn't mean a goddamn thing. There's chaos in the violence, and maybe all of this is all you get. So fill your heart with love, what you can while you are here. And don't you dare believe them when they try to tell you everything happens for a reason, because it doesn't mean a goddamn thing. There's chaos in the violence, and it's so insensitive to claim for no reason every day.
Dodsworth by Sinclair Lewis, an excerpt. The aristocracy of Zenith were dancing at the Kennepoos Canoe Club. They two-stepped on the wide porch with its pillars of pine trunks, its bobbing Japanese lanterns, and never were their dance frocks with wider sleeves nor hair more sensuously piled on little smiling heads. Never an August evening more moon-washed and spacious and proper for respectable romance. Three guests had come in these newfangled automobiles, for it was now 1903, the climax of civilization. A fourth automobile was approaching, driven by Samuel Dodsworth. The scene was a sentimental chromo, crisping lake, lovers in canoes singing, "Nellie was a lady," all very lugubrious and happy. And Sam Dodsworth enjoyed it. He was a large and formidable young man with a healthy brown mustache and a chaos of brown hair on a massive head. He was, at 28, assistant superintendent of that most noisy and unsentimental institution, the Zenith Locomotive Works. And in Yale, class of 1896, he had played better than average football, but he thought well of the most sentimental sorts of moonlight. Tonight, he was particularly uplifted because he was driving his first car, and it was none of your old-fashioned gasoline buggies with the engine under the seat. The engine bulked in front under a proud hood over 2 feet long, and the steering column was not straight but rakishly tilted. The car was sporting and rather dangerous, and the lights were powerful affairs fed by acetylene gas. Sam sped on with a feeling of power, of dominating the universe at 12 dizzy miles an hour. At the canoe club, he was greeted by Tub Pearson, admirable in white kid gloves. Tub, Thomas J. Pearson, round and short and jolly, class jester and class dandy at Yale, had been Sam Dodsworth's roommate and chief admirer throughout college. But now Tub had begun to take on an irritable dignity as teller and future president of his father's bank in Zenith. "It runs," Tub marveled as Sam stepped in triumph from the car. "I've got a horse all ready to tow you back." Tub had to be witty, whatever happened. "Certainly it runs. I'll bet I was up to 18 miles an hour." "Yeah, I'll bet that someday automobiles will run 40. Tub jeered. "Sure. Why, they'll just about drive the poor old horse right off the highway." "They will. And I'm thinking of tying up with this new Revelation company to manufacture 'em." "Not seriously, you poor chump." "Yes." "Oh, my Lord," Tub wailed affectionately. "Don't be crazy, Sambo. My dad says automobiles are nothing but a fad. Cost too much to run. In 5 years, he says, they'll disappear." Sam's answer was not very logical. "Who's the young angel on the porch?" If she was an angel, the girl at whom Sam was pointing, she was an angel of ice, slim, shining, ash blonde, her self-possessed voice very cool as she parried the complimentary teasing of half a dozen admirers, a crystal candlestick of a girl among black and white lumps of males. "You remember her? Frances Volker, Fran Volker, old Herman's kid. She's been abroad for a year, and she was east in finishing school. Before that, just a brat. Isn't over 19 or 20, I guess. Golly, they say she speaks German and French and Italian and woof-woof and all known languages." Herman Volker had brewed his way into millions and respectably. His house was almost the largest in Zenith. Certainly, it had the greatest amount of turrets, colored glass windows, and lace curtains, and he was leader among the German-Americans who were supplanting the New Englanders throughout the state as controllers of finance and merchandising. He entertained German professors when they came lecturing and looking, and it was asserted that one of the genuine hand-painted pictures which he had recently brought back from Nuremberg was worth nearly $10,000. A worthy citizen, Herman, and his tart beer was admirable, but that this beef-colored burger should have fathered anything so poised and luminous as Fran was a miracle. The sight of her made Sam Dodsworth feel clumsy as a St. Bernard looking at a white kitten. While he prophesied triumphs for the motor car, while he danced with other girls, he observed her airy dancing and her laughter. Normally, he was not particularly afraid of young women, but Fran Volker seemed too fragile for his thick hands. Not till 10 did he speak to her, when a partner left her, a flushed Corybant, in a chair near Sam's. "Do you remember me?"
"Dodsworth.
Years since I've seen you." "Remember? Heavens! I wondered if you were going to notice me. I used to steal the newspaper from Dad to get the news of your football heroisms. And when I was a nice young devil of 8, you once chased me out of your orchard for stealing apples. Did I? Wouldn't dare to now. Maybe next dance? Well, let me see. Oh, the next is with Levering Mott, and he's already ruined 3 of my 2 slippers. Yes. If he did not dance with any particular neatness, a girl knew where she was, with Sam Dotsworth. He had enough strength and decision to let a young woman understand who was doing the piloting. With Fran Volker, he was inspired. He waltzed as though he was proud of his shining burden. He held her lightly enough, and, after the chaste custom of the era, his hands were gloved, but his fingertips felt a current from her body. He knew that she was the most exquisite child in the world. He knew that he was going to marry her and keep her forever in a shrine. He knew that, after years of puzzled wonder about the purpose of life, he had found it. She's like a lily. No, she's too lively. She's like a hummingbird. No, too kind of dignified. She's, oh, she's a flame. Beckons you. Pipsqueak parody and chopstick love, as the souls of the little ones teem wondrous, fragile, beautiful, and closer to true, the myths beckoning the good that resides way up above. And September sun rays shine at yellow light angles, so warm and soothing, speaking from the soulfulness of this planet Earth. For a moment or two, I feel nourished and true. My neighborhood beckons you.
Chimney falls as lovers play. I thought that I was young. Now I've freezing hands and bloodless veins, as numb as I've become. I'm so tired, I wish I was the moon tonight. Last night I dreamt I'd forgotten my name, 'cause I sold my soul, but I woke just the same. I'm so lonely, and I wish I was the moon tonight. God bless me, I'm a free man with no place free to go. For what I fear, this is crazy, and I wish I was the moon tonight. Chimney falls as lovers play. I thought that I was young. Now I'm freezing hands and bloodless veins, as numb as I've become. I'm so tired, I wish I was the moon tonight. How will you know if you found me at last? 'Cause I'll be the one, be the one, be the one with my heart in my lap. I'm so tired, I'm so tired, and I wish I was the moon.
And there you have it, episode 235 of Troubadours and Rock on Tours. Straight back from our summer August repos, as is our tradition. It is good to be back. I hope you enjoyed the program. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, my good friend and our resident sage, Almighty Todd, sharing some time with us from his farm in Stockbridge, Vermont. Thank you so much, Almighty Todd. It was a really nice experience talking with you. I also like to thank Sinclair Lewis for being a brilliant writer. I'd like to thank these musical artists too: Django Reinhardt and Stefan Grappelli, The Temptations, Gil Scott-Heron, Eric Bachman, OK Patty, Nico Case, Branford Marsalis, and Terrence Blanchard, too. Next week, we have famed, renowned essayist and cartoonist Timothy Kreider on the program. It'll be a great conversation, I assure you.
Until then, have a great week.